The future is within our grasp. It is a future fair for all. Now, all of us, let's go to it.
It's the most important general election for a generation.
I think this is a huge, huge election. I mean, it's certainly the beginning of the end for Brown.
But they would say that, wouldn't they?
Indeed. And there'll be plenty more of that for the next month and, of course, for the rest of this podcast.
With us in the studio today are two top Guardian columnists, Anne Perkins and Seamus Milne. Very quick question, have we seen any flagrant electioneering, Seamus? I'm thinking of Cameron and his quiff. It was when he announced the election, his hairstyle was uncontrolled, which is not usual.
Shirt sleeves,
yeah.
Hope and change, yeah. Fear.
Reagan.
Yeah, we're in there right away.
Anne?
You know what, I hope you would see some flagrant electioneering.
But no baby kissing. Election.
I think baby kissing belongs to an earlier, gentler time.
Tom?
Well, I don't think so. I think they're too self-conscious now because they know everything will go viral on the internet. If they look like they're hugging a calf or something, it will suddenly be set to music by some kid in Miami.
Well, there's no doubt about it. This election is going to be all about numbers. The Tories need to gain a stonking 116 seats to get an absolute majority. They have to be at least 10 points clear of Labour. But getting there isn't going to be easy, as top political blogger Mike Smithson explains.
The real problem, the real reason why there is so much uncertainty at the moment is that nobody can really master the electoral mathematics. I mean, if the Tories were 12-15% ahead, then it would be absolutely certain they would be forming a government and there'd be no argument about it. But it's because we're in this very grey area when we're trying to convert vote shares into seats and trying to make an accurate projection, that it does make it extremely difficult. And I think that this is going to go on and on. I can't see the Tories getting more than 10-11% leads in the polls in the run-up to the election, but I can't see them getting, say, lower than 5 or 6% leads. The current polls are saying, well, the Guardian ICM poll, which had a 4% lead, and that was carried out during the bank holiday period, which are notoriously unreliable. The other polls we've had are online internet polling, and they're showing leads of 8, 9, 10%. But the polls are going to play an overwhelmingly important role. They will be certainly, for instance, shall we say, after next week's debate, if the Tories go up a bit, everybody say, well, it was all down to Brown's performance in the debate. If the Tories go down, they'll be saying it the other way around. And the trouble is in all of this is that polls are, you know, they're interesting, they're quite sophisticated, but they're not that accurate.
So we've had our daily batch of polls this morning with Tory leads of, take your pick, 5, 7 or 11 points.
OK, well, I'm going to pick the middle one, 7 points. Tom, what would that actually mean in terms of the final result?
The important thing to remember is there's not one election going on. There's 650 different ones in each of the different seats across the country. And what matters is how far support swings from Labour to the Conservatives in every one of those. And that 7-point lead would probably mean that the Tories would walk away with something like 300 seats, not the 326 that they need to be running the country on their own.
Seamus, the national picture, they should be, I mean, you've written before, they should be sort of at 50 points, shouldn't they, the Tories?
Well, if you take into account, you know, that the government's been in power for 13 years, they've had the biggest, we've been through the biggest economic crisis since the 1930s, living standards are falling, and Brown is an unpopular leader. I mean, it is really extraordinary that the Tories aren't doing better, and the fact that the government has come back, or Labour's come back in the last few months in the way it has, I think is pretty significant and reflects, you know, a more sure-footed performance and a beginning to appeal more to their own voters by Labour in recent months. But I think they have come unstuck in the last couple of weeks in a very clear way over most recently the national insurance issue. But all before that, I think they allowed themselves to be pinned on the issue of cuts deeper than Thatcher.
Isn't there something sort of historic here, which is you have a resurgent or a popular third party and that nibbles away, and it's what in the 90s Blair didn't have, so that's why he was able to soar away into the 50s?
Well, the Liberals and the Liberal Democrats generally have done better in when Labour's been in power. But actually, if you look at the figures, they're not doing that well. They haven't eaten that significantly into the position. But I mean, what has clearly happened in the last couple of weeks is that Labour's narrowing of the Tory poll lead, which I think clearly reflected some sure-footed appeals to their own voters in recent months has come unstuck on, first of all, they're allowing themselves to be pinned on the idea of cuts as deep as Margaret Thatcher's time, which really isn't a very clever thing to do. And the second thing is obviously over the Tories' national insurance manoeuvre, which may itself come unstuck, but has certainly been initially quite successful.
And if you take a step back, you see this great flurry of polls coming out every day. Sometimes they're up, sometimes they're down. Do you have any confidence at all? Could they be completely wrong? And could we find that Labour's actually ahead?
I think it's very unlikely they'd be completely wrong. And I disagree with, although the immensely knowledgeable Mr. Smithson, because I think actually polls are pretty accurate, but they're only snapshots. They're not, and therefore you have to look at the trends, not at the, you can't compare ICM with opinion with YouGov. You have to keep backtracking to look at what ICM found last time, because the methodologies are different and because trends are much more reliable if you're trying to make predictions than individual snapshots.
But do you think it's quite hard to see that trend, because we know that they can bounce about within what they call this margin of error of 2 or 3 points here or there, and they're coming out every day now, and every day we get a new headline about them.
I think I quite agree you shouldn't trust the headlines. I think you do need to be, and I think any reliable reporting will tell you how it compares with previous surveys by the same outfit, rather than comparing them with across the field.
And the other unanswered question here, of course, is whether what's going on in those marginal seats is different from what's going on in the...
And the evidence is that it is, that the Ashcroft money, which has gone in a really big way into winnable marginals by the Tories, is reflecting, at the moment, a bigger swing. It might just be a higher identification factor, but we don't know whether it'll last, but it's there at the moment.
And that, of course, makes the whole thing even more imponderable if different things are going on in different places. But there's plenty more on polls, swings and political maps on The Guardian's website to try and help you make sense of it all.
I'm Matt Wells. I'm the general election editor for Guardian.co.uk. The centrepiece of our coverage is our daily live blog, which is written by a master of the genre, Andrew Sparrow, who's our chief political correspondent. Everything you need to know about all the day's political developments are in there, from first thing in the morning until last thing at night. We've also got some neat tools. We have, everyone has a swingometer. Our one, though, is the only one that swings three ways at once. You can play around with that and see how different types of swing would affect the outcome around the country. We have a poll of polls, which keeps track of all the disparate opinion polls, gives you a better idea about the general trend in those surveys. And from Monday, we'll have a daily election podcast, Guardian Election Daily, presented by our veteran commentator, Michael White. And we've also got, of course, the road shows of Politics Weekly. We're on the road in Birmingham on the 20th of April, and we're in London on the 4th of May. Tickets for those are available online at guardian.co.uk/politicsweekly. And the home of all our election coverage is guardian.co.uk/election2010.
Well, what should we be expecting from the next 4 weeks, and what exactly do we want? Our sketch writer, Simon Hoggart, has seen quite a few elections in his time. He thinks we've already had a pretty good idea of what kind of campaign we're going to get.
Well, I think we do, yes. What the Tories are saying is a tax on jobs will mean that unemployment gets worse. We had a rehearsal of it in Prime Minister's Question Time. Labour are going to be saying the Tories are going to take £6 billion out of the economy. They say it's waste. But, you know, even waste is people's jobs. You know, if you say to somebody, your job is waste, we're not going to go on paying you anymore, then they feel very resentful. And if they think their job might be described as waste, then they're going to feel extremely fearful. So I think that's going to be a very, very major theme. Labour are certainly going to predict that the Tories are going to play havoc with education, policing and the NHS. The Tories are going to produce all kinds of figures to say, no, they're absolutely protected, and defence while we're at it. Basically, it's a hopeless situation, and what we're really seeing is a bunch of shipwrecked mariners in an open boat arguing which cabin boy to eat first. I'd love to see a wonderfully high-minded campaign in which only honest statistics are bandied, in which people say precisely what they intend to do, stick to their promises if they win. Do I think we're going to get one? Are you mad? What world are you living in?
So, Simon says he knows what kind of campaign we're going to get, Anne, and he says it's going to be grim. What kind would you actually want, though?
Oh, well, I'm obviously with Simon on the high-minded, serious political, philosophical issues. But I'm also with Simon on that it's really about which cabin boy to eat. And I think one of the things that's been most remarkable, both in the pre-campaign and now, is how extraordinary, kind of driven by the other side, the two main parties are, and how reactive, and how consequently you get no sense of overall direction, really, from either party. I think it ends up making them both look rather weak. It reminds me of the conversation that The Guardian and The Daily Mail sometimes has, which most Guardian readers won't notice because they don't read The Daily Mail. I mean, it's kind of completely self-defeating. And I think it makes them look very inward-looking as well. And I wish that all the campaigners would be directed at us and at things that we think are important, rather than at a kind of narrow fencing match.
Isn't the real thing, Seamus, the most particular example of that, the fact that the public is being told it's in for cuts, and it's being told it's been landed with this big bill because it went on with the city, and it wants to know why?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it'd be nice to have a campaign in which issues like the war in Afghanistan, privatisation, what to do with a broken economic model were discussed at the centre of the campaign, because these are the big issues facing the country. But none of those will, because all the parties agree about them. But I think, you know, you have started to see, to some extent, with Brown and also with people like Vince Cable in the Lib Dems, you know, some addressing of those issues. But those aren't really being discussed in the campaign and probably won't be. You know, what you're going to have is, as in all election campaigns, focus on very, very narrow arguments like the one about national insurance, which don't necessarily illuminate the real issues facing the country or the things people want to discuss. And that's the problem about the way these campaigns are run.
But take a day like yesterday, where Brown tried to make a speech, well, did make a speech about constitutional reform. Does it have any effect? Are people talking about it up and down the land or not?
I think constitutional reform, curiously, is one of those reasons why politicians don't talk about important things, because they haven't found yet a way, even after the expenses scandal, of talking about them in a way that people say, oh, yeah, that's about my life, you know. I think the lack of discussion about constitutional reform is one of the things I miss most and mine most. And if we're talking about new models, it's the thing that really, really has to be addressed. But I think it's very hard to do it in a general election campaign.
It's a classic of the genre, because he's talking about it as a high-minded thing, but we know that he chose to make it one of his earliest announcements because he sees it as this terrible thing called a dividing line.
But it was also a very early announcement when he became Prime Minister. And
indeed, first day.
And you know, I'm afraid he's seriously damaged goods on that. And I think the behaviour in the last 48 hours in the wash-up period has absolutely given the lie to, and I think actually has kind of demonstrated everything that we don't like about Gordon Brown, his kind of willingness to say things for advantage and then not to follow through. And I think it kind of really reinforces aspects of Brown's character.
It's got to be appealing to Lib Dems, though, hasn't it, that some of that stuff? I mean, it may not, you know, appeal very much in the country as a whole, but to some Lib Dem voters, it's surely going to be
But Seamus, give them credit for being able to see through something like that. I mean, I really don't think a Lib Dem voter is going to suddenly feel better about Gordon Brown and his record on constitutional reform, because he makes a speech.
No, but if there's a clear commitment to, electing the House of Lords and a referendum on Navy.
There's a sort of dual Lib Dem thing, though, isn't there? There's, on the one hand, trying to grab the voters. Probably more realistically, there's the, if we have to do business, this is the way in which we do it.
That's what I was talking about, really. Yeah.
Can we just focus for a minute on national insurance, which just seemed to be the only issue that's getting any traction so far, Seamus? The Tories have got, whether we like it or not, a nice simple message, which is, we'll give you a tax cut. Labour doesn't seem to know exactly what its message is. Is it going to put money into the economy, or is it going to be very prudent?
Well, I think Labour were outmanoeuvred by the Tories twice. First, on the fact that the Tories managed last year to make the centre of public debate the deficit rather than the crisis and the slump. And then, having, you know, banged on for months and months about how the deficit was the greatest crisis facing the country, they've now seen that's damaging to them as people were starting to be more fearful of cuts, turned it round and said, well, actually, the deficit's not that important. What we really need to do is cut the taxes that the government's planning to put up to pay for the deficit. And so the government was outmaneuvered in that. But I think there is an opportunity for Labour in showing that, you know, the phoniness of that earlier message, that if the deficit was so overwhelmingly important, then why aren't they seeking to cut that rather than make tax cuts? And highlight the competence issue and trust issue with the Tories, which I think probably is quite fruitful for Labour.
Because actually, when you come down to the hard figures, it is actually a very small distinction in terms of the balance between tax raising and cutting, how many pounds you take out of public spending, and we should never think of from the heat and fury of the last couple of days.
But isn't there also a question about this debate is being played out in terms of business leaders lining up for the Conservatives, and are business leaders as taken as seriously as they were before the credit crunch?
I think business leaders are. I think you've got to just make a distinction between business and the city. And I just think it's quite extraordinary how familiar we have become in the last 5 or 10 years with, you know, the chief executives of our big companies and mainly our retail outlets, actually. But, you know, there's a kind, you know, Stuart Rose leaves, somebody else arrives, and suddenly they're, you know, they're being interviewed everywhere. We practically know kind of their shirt sizes. And you know, this whole thing about business and brands is almost a kind of surrogate for, you know, other forms of shared public life.
The fact that they're called leaders, while trade union officials are described as trade union bosses in the media, I think is very revealing. But I mean, I wonder whether the distinction between the city and the corporate sector is as strong as Anne's saying. I mean, it definitely does exist, but I wonder whether actually these executives and corporates lining up to back the Tories, who they expect to be in power and expect to have favours done for them, might not be cutting both ways politically.
So, Seamus, on that basis, Labour should run against business.
Well, there was an argument yesterday in government and in the Labour leadership about whether to hit back at the business leaders, and they decided not to for the reasons that people have been talking about. But I'm not sure that was the right decision, really.
Even though they've already called them deceived.
Well, they backed off that, haven't they?
This week, Jeremy Paxman accused the leaders of the political parties of parading their wives around like toys with a pulse. And we've gone back 50 years in a week here, haven't we?
I don't think we've gone back. I mean, political wives used to be absolutely invisible, except Violet Attlee's head poking above the steering wheel of the car in which she was ferrying her prime minister husband around the country. No, I think this is...
So forward to a terrible future
forward
instead.
I think much more forward to a terrible future, much more about... it's much more to do with the kind of whole presidential approach of politics and buying the kind of whole man, the whole family, you know, and I cringe when I see that we're running a style feature on the Prime Minister's wives or the would-be Prime Minister's wives. I think the whole thing is really sick-making.
But you've got to give Nick Clegg and Miriam Gonzalez, his wife here, a bit of credit,
haven't
you? Give
her 10 out of 10.
She just went to work as normal, yeah. While, you know,
someone's
Sam
got
Cam,
to earn some money.
Sam Cam is been described by David Cameron
Shame
as his secret weapon.
Why are they doing it? They're clearly doing it for some kind of focus group that suggests it's a good idea, mustn't there be?
Well, I think Anne's right. It's intended to appeal to a certain part of the electorate that is very, very focused on the personalities and the sort of soap opera dimension of politics as ideology is sort of driven and the political choices are driven from the centre of debate. Of course, we had Dennis Thatcher when Margaret Thatcher was in power parading about behind her at all times. And I think in the end, in a strange way, he did become a sort of asset to her, even though if he had actually ever opened his mouth, it would have been a total disaster, because it would have revealed how hideously reactionary he was and really she was as well. But I think it is a pretty negative phenomenon, because it is about the depoliticisation of politics and the attempt to turn it into a sort of personality context, which is completely phony.
Yeah, we did. I was trying to think. I mean, in a way, he kind of put spouses on the map, didn't he? Although Mary Wilson and her poetry used to feature in some quarters. She was never on parade. I mean, she refused to move to Downing Street, didn't she? She was never...
Could it backfire, Anne?
Certainly, I wrote a piece saying that, and got there was a lot of enthusiasm for that point of view. But you see, the curious thing is that, you know, people say they don't like these things, but at the same time they absolutely lap it up. I mean, you know,
people want to know about other people's lives, don't they?
People want to know about other people's lives. Yes, and there's a kind of awful attraction about.
But also they're helpful to the to Cameron and Brown in the sense that both of them, in, especially maybe Samantha Cameron, are actually cooler than their husbands in some way, and therefore they do give them a little bit of extra credibility, which they're lacking. In the case of Sarah Brown, she's obviously got a more human approach and style, which can appeal to people.
As a PR professional.
Exactly.
Anyone more appealing than our top politicians, it's hard to imagine, isn't it? But that is it for this week. Remember, from next week, you'll be getting a daily podcast dose from Mike White in our Guardian Election Day.
Remember also to book your tickets for our own Birmingham and London roadshows.
Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Tom Clark.
I'm Allegra Stratton.
And from both of us,
goodbye.